was a geologist for about 15 years before switching gears. I'm also secretary treasurer of the Canadian Scientific and Christian Affiliation, which is the Canadian arm of the ASA. Well, if extraterrestrial life is ever to be discovered or confirmed, it's likely to be in the form of an ancient fossilized bacteria or a microbe. Such a discovery would bring with it much scientific controversy as well as theological intrigue. Just to outline the focus of the talk, I'm going to explore some of that controversy and intrigue in the following ways. Review what is called the Mars rock story, compare it to other earthly controversies, and then note some creation-focused Christian theology and ask the question, is there really a problem here? And this is really an update of an ASA talk that I gave in 2003, and I really appreciate the opportunity to make that update. Now, 15 years ago this summer, a hastily produced press conference had then President Clinton share news of a startling discovery by some NASA scientists and associates. The president cited the discovery as possibly one of the most stunning insights into our universe that science has ever uncovered. Now, some of you have actually seen this announcement in a slightly different way, as a clip was used in the movie Contact, starring Jodie Foster. But that, of course, was quite a different context. The real news, was of proposed fossilized microbes found in a 2-kilogram, 4-billion-year-old potato-shaped rock established to be a meteorite from Mars. The work was led by NASA geologist David McKay with a host of associates, and the discovery was published about a week later in Science. The rock has become both famous and infamous. It's called ALH84001 after the Allen Hills area in Antarctica, where it was discovered on the ice in 1984. The full story is recounted in the book shown here, The Rock from Mars, by Pulitzer nominee Kathy Sawyer. Now, in the original paper, there were numerous cautionary notes, but also the conclusion that when all the features were considered collectively, there is evidence for primitive life on Mars. And so that included carbonate minerals similar to those metabolized by bacteria on Earth, segmented rod-like structures as shown here, resembling bacterial forms, although they were very, very small, tiny crystals of the mineral magnetite of a nature known to be secreted by terrestrial bacteria due to the Earth's magnetic field, and also some hydrocarbon compounds, specifically polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which, of course, are known to have in part an affinity with a biogenic material and commonly described as the kind of thing you find clinging to your barbecue grill. So, as expected, this raised a great deal of controversy and a great deal of interest. Before the year was out, the New York Times noted that on Mars, life is getting tougher, attributing to the doubt were studies on temperatures of formations of the carbonates, the vague nature of the internal structures seen, concerns over contamination, and misinterpretation due to the complex microscopy used. And the role of the magnetite minerals were also challenged, as Mars does not have a magnetic field. So one primary and initial critic who was invited by NASA to respond was UCLA's Precambrian life expert J. William Schopf, who we will meet a little later. So the controversy after 15 years shows no sign of being resolved, and circumstances are such, I think, that it may never be. McKay and his colleagues put out another paper in late 2010, after presenting information at some conferences earlier that year. The paper showed further support for the original claims, using results from the current Mars surveys and also work on other meteorites. This included the discovery that Mars did have a magnetic field early in its history. Now, I think it is noteworthy, however, to note that the paper itself was published without any fanfare, certainly no press coverage this time, and not really in a journal of common note, I would suggest, but in a NASA publication entitled Instruments and Methods for Astrobiology and Planetary Missions. It's also worth noting that another paper by NASA scientist Richard Hoover was presented in the Harvard Journal Cosmology in March of 2011. Hoover reported that he had found microbial fossils in a class of rare meteorites. The paper was published on online on a Friday. It is said it went viral over the weekend with much critique, even from top NASA scientists, who the press at least report disavowed the research by Monday at noon. So the controversies continue. But this kind of thing has been going on for some time. One of the first controversies concerning the discovery of microbial life on Earth developed in a Canadian setting in the latter half of the 19th century. In 1859, rocks from the Ottawa Valley were displayed by Sir William Logan, who was head of the Geological Survey of Canada, at the annual meeting of the AAAS. The rocks showed intriguing similarities to younger fossil-rich rocks, only these rocks were azoic, as they were called at the time, meaning before life, and what we would now call the Precambrian. Logan forwarded these rocks to his colleague and friend J. William Dawson, a noted geologist, paleontologist, and principal of McGill University, and you can see the long tenure of that work as principal of 1855 to 1893. Now, working in collaboration with a Canadian chemist and a British microfossil expert, Dawson soon declared the rocks to contain fossils of microscopic life, and Dawson named the fossils Eozoan canadense, or Dawn Animal of Canada. Evidence cited by Dawson and his colleagues included carbonate structures similar to the appearance of younger fossils, well-preserved microscopic organic features, abundant carbon or graphite in surrounding rocks, and the occurrence of iron-rich beds, which even in the 1860s were thought to have biological affinities. And as if to parallel the comment on the Mars rock research, Dawson maintained that the evidence is most impressive when all the factors are taken together collectively. Now, you may have noticed that the evidence cited by Dawson, shown there on the right, is remarkably similar to that put forth by the supporters of the Martian fossils. The carbonate minerals, the fossil shapes, the iron oxides, and the presence of carbon or hydrocarbon. Now, there is, of course, an obvious difference of scale from the nanometer features of the Martian evidence through to the kilometers that Dawson used in his regional geological support. Dawson described these discoveries as a jewel in the crown of the Young Geological Survey of Canada. While the sparkle, however, was quickly tarnished by controversy concerning the authenticity of these fossils. Before the century was out, some 240 papers on the matter were published, including at least 60 by Dawson himself. And criticisms again had similarities, as you can see here, to the problems with the Martian microbes. Non-organic processes that can mimic biological ones. The temperature of formations were too high. Fossil structures were either imaginary or misinterpreted, and that kind of thing. So it is generally considered that the origin of Eozoan was clarified by the turn of the century in the late 1800s, wherein most of the supposed organic structures and minerals were accepted to be due to the geological process known as contact metamorphism. So essentially, Dawson was, for the most part, quite incorrect. Charles Doolittle Walcott of Burgess Shale fame is generally credited with the first discovery of confirmed Precambrian fossils from a horizon in the Grand Canyon sequence. These and other Doolittle features and discoveries were heavily critiqued, however, and challenged by a Cambridge professor a botanist, A.C. Seward, in the 1930s. But eventually, as it turned out, this time Walcott was deemed, for the most part, to be correct. Now, a major advance in the subject came with a paper published in Science in 1954 by Stanley Tyler and Elso Barghorn. This was the discovery of microfossils in a unit known as the Gunflint Chert, found in the, along the north shore of Lake Superior. And it dated at around 1.9 billion years. I might add that working under Barghorn's supervision on this was a young, enthusiastic grad student by the name of J. William Schopf. And so perhaps no discovery then is more intriguing or controversial than that of now UCLA's geologist, Dr. J. William, or Bill Schopf. Schopf came into particular fame through the identification of various microfossils from the Apex Chert of Western Australia. Such fossils come with the staggering date of 3.46 billion years old. Now, his work was also published in Science, in fact, 39 years to the day of the Tyler Barghorn paper. Well, an ongoing disagreement, however, has been carried out since the turn of the millennium between Bill Schopf and what I would describe as the UCLA group and Martin Brasier and the Oxford group. In March of 2002, there were sequential papers printed by each group in the journal Nature. And this was followed by a well-documented debate at a NASA-sponsored astrobiology conference just a month later. And the debate has taken on an aura not unlike that of the Wilberforce-Huxley debate of Darwin's time. And many were there noting the irony of Mars microbe critic Bill Schopf now defending his own startling evidence for early life. Well, Schopf continues to build his case using a variety of analytical techniques, while the Brasier group continues to press the burden of proof being required in establishing beyond a reasonable doubt that the features being examined cannot be formed by non-biogenic processes. In Brasier's words, instead of asking what do these structures remind us of, the question should be, what are these structures? Now, both sides agree that it is perhaps impossible to prove beyond question the biogenic nature of these earliest fossils. Well, as the smoke clears, if it ever will, over such controversies and research, I think the following points become apparent and are useful. One is that despite debate and disagreement, there is a very strong general consensus that fossilized microbes on our planet have been and will be identified dating as old as at least 3 billion years. Secondly, there is, however, considerable debate and disagreement over the specific representatives of the oldest organisms. So thirdly, I think we should note, therefore, that if there are such challenges for specific samples from a planet with known life, how much more difficult might it be for something from limited samples from, well, from beyond or who knows where? And I believe these points are important to keep in mind as we move to theological implications. At the time of the 1996 announcement, there was a flurry surrounding not only the science, but also faith issues. It seems, however, that such concern was primarily manifested and raised by the media. It was noted by theologian Chris Kaiser that, and I quote, "Religious editors across the nation telephoned their local biology professors and theologians to see if another battle between science and religion might be brewing." And a good example comes from the comments of Jesuit astronomer Guy Consolmagno. He described such an encounter in his book entitled Brother Astronomer. He was contacted by the religion editor of Newsweek the day of the August press conference and asked about its religious significance. He writes, "I thought for a microsecond, none that I can think of," was his response. "Hmm," said the editor, "that's kind of what I thought too, but my editor says I have two columns to fill by 5 o'clock. After further conversation and prodding, Brother Guy said, "Well, the science is surprising, But there is nothing surprising from a religious point of view about God creating life elsewhere. God can do what God wants. That's the whole point of being God. Well, the editor said, well, that wouldn't be a very appropriate quote. So Brother Guy simply concluded, well, finding life on another planet is merely an indication of God's creative power. Well, if we invoke that creative power, let us return to the originator of the Aozoan Canadense controversy. Sir William Dawson was not only a respected educator and scientist of his time, but he was a prominent evangelical Presbyterian. Now, before we move on, I simply show this slide to show you the number of scientific honors, amongst others, that he has received. But I think the most notable is the fact that he is the only scientist ever to have been president of both the American Affiliation for the Advancement of Science and the British Affiliation for the Advancement of Science. Now, in synthesizing the new ideas of geology in the time with his strong biblically rooted faith, Dawson shared his thoughts in a number of books. Now, these were written for the general public, reconciling the ancient age of the earth and ancient life with a creation-focused theology. The books have such titles as The Origin of the World According to Science and Scripture, Nature in the Bible, Modern Ideas of Evolution as Related to Revelation and Scripture. He wrote 14 such books in all. With the scientific parallels noted between the Martian fossil and Aozoan controversies, it's very tempting for myself to also dip into Dawson's extensive theological commentary as well. In Dawson's eyes, the Bible has always proved itself to be an active stimulant of natural science, accepting the principle that it embraces the universe in its unity, comprising both terrestrial life and the luminous realms of space. And Dawson also suggests that to God, time and space are not limited as they are to us, and the microscopically small may be as relatively as great as that which seems to us to be almost infinitely large. God is present and efficient in all, from the immensity of the universe down to the humblest atom. Secondly, Dawson saw the presence of life, even if it's in its most unusual forms, as an attestation of the act of creation. Dawson was most impressed by the observations of Arctic explorers and their discovery of simple microscopic marine life forms in extremely harsh environments. And Dawson suggests that the phrase, God created, is sufficient answer to the primary cause of this force. Well, with some of this foundation in mind, let's quickly move to the present time. And for the sake of this discussion, I'm going to confine my comments to the impact of extraterrestrial, non-intelligent life, such as bacteria. And it's my personal and current belief that that may be as far as it will ever go. Well, since the first announcement of the possible Martian microbes in 1996, there have been a variety of conferences and papers and research work done exploring the impact of such a discovery on religion and Christianity in particular. For examples of conferences, I'm just going to look at some of the more recent ones. The, as shown here, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in Rome hosted a study group in November of 2009 and included not only members of the Vatican Observatory, but a number of prominent non-believer scientists as well. The cartoon shown here is from the Washington Post coverage of the event. In 2010, there were at least two prominent scientific organizations hosting such conferences. The Royal Society held their conference in January, and that included a number of well-known scientists, as well as respected theologians such as Lutheran Ted Peters. A month later, the AAAS and their group, the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion, hosted a forum on, and I quote, the implications of finding other worlds. And our own ASA past president, Jennifer Wiseman, who now leads that study group, presented a paper entitled Uniqueness of Earth and the Significance of Life in Christian Perspectives. My main point in showing you all of this is the trend that these possible discoveries and astrobiology itself and thoughts on extraterrestrial life seems to be a very useful tool in getting scientists and theologians sharing and talking. Now, out of such work is coming a consensus that parallels the creation theology of Sir William Dawson and no doubt many others. I just share some specific examples from different orientations within our denomination, within our Christian faith. First of all, Ted Peters, who has been studying this topic for some 30 years now, notes that the discovery of life beyond the realm of our own planet helps expand our vision of what, and I quote, all creation means, and thus enhancing our understanding of our Creator God. Prominent Catholic theologian John Haught sees this as an opportunity for theology to widen and deepen its understanding of divine creativity. And similarly, from the Eastern Orthodox perspective, discovery of such life forms, and I quote, poses neither an intellectual nor spiritual threat, unquote. But in fact, it can add to or re-energize our awe and our wonder of creation. So one might wonder then, why all the fuss? Well, Ted Peters has been wondering this for many years. So he recently completed work on what he called the ETL, or Extraterrestrial Life Religious Crisis Survey. And this was a very comprehensive survey of 1,300 respondents of varying Christian groups and non-believers as well. Now, the results can easily be found online. So I'm just going to summarize 2 points here. And he has it all broken down into different denominational segments, etc. The first is that 85 to 95% of religious believers saw no threat to personal beliefs. But, and the second point is, a significant majority, at least 65% of non-believers, are far more fearful, or also in his words, gleeful, of a religious crisis. So you have to think about that for a bit. So, in considering the theological impact of the discovery of fossil microbial life beyond our planet, I would simply propose some following conclusions. First of all, the confirmation of extraterrestrial microbial life may take many, many years, even after preliminary discoveries. People of faith should be aware of this, and therefore not jump to conclusions or feel forced into a crisis of faith. There's lots of time to work it out and to think about it. Secondly, it's the media and the non-believing community that suggests great problems for religion and Christianity in particular. And I would suggest that this also includes the members of now what is known under various titles as the New Atheism and Richard Dawkins, etc. This is the kind of thing that I suspect that they would jump all over. I would suggest this can simply be called the sky is falling syndrome. And finally, many theologians and believer scientists see this as a blessing to enrich our understanding of our Creator God and to elevate our place and responsibility in the cosmos. Now, looking at it just one other way, I can suggest that Psalm 8 still applies. In fact, I would suggest it applies even more so than when the ancient psalmist surveyed the dark, starry skies of the Holy Land and did what we all do, sort of question our existence, question who we are. And the psalmist asks, in view of it all, when I look at your heavens and the work of your fingers and the moon and the stars that you have made and have established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them? But of course, the psalmist answers his own question. You, God, have crowned us with glory and honor and have given us dominion over such works. So humanity, we celebrate, is still, at the center of salvation history. Spiritual wonder and responsibility that comes from admiring starry skies, long lost, I think, in the glare of the civilized world, it just might well return, and particularly if we find some life out there too. Thank you very much.
You have 5 minutes for questions.
Okay. Any questions? Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
How would humanity still be the center of salvation if we find intelligent life out there?
Well, I think that could, it depends on what kind of intelligent life it is, but you see, my point is, because that's the question that is always raised, I don't think we're going to find intelligent life out there. So I do suspect there is bacterial life out there in the universe, and this is the spot where it developed by God's help and wisdom into humanity. But it's a big if question. And even finding life out there of any kind, is a big if question. But it depends on what kind of intelligent life it is, what kind of sentient being it might be. But I think still within that realm, there may well be ways that we're still the center of salvation history. If this is the spot, as we believe that God sent Jesus to come and save us on behalf of creation, well, that could still work in my mind.
Just a quick follow-up. Why could not salvation history be polycentric with 10 to 20 second stars?
Well, it could be. Yeah. Yes?
Could you help me technically?
Sure.
The Mars rock?
Yes.
Well,
the primary evidence that it is from Mars is that they were able to get some gas from tiny air vesicles contained in the rock. And they measured that gas, and it came out to show almost, well, it was identical to the kind of atmospheric testing that the Viking Mars explorers established back in the 60s, and there are Deb may be able to help me with this, but there are some half a dozen or maybe more meteorites that have been determined to be Martian of origin because of that one quality, and it's the ratio of the gases and some I think there's some xenon there and the amount of carbon dioxide, etc. So that was what they used. And so once they discovered that, that's when they started to do more work on this particular meteorite. Well, thank you very much, then. Enjoy the rest of the conference.